be talking about atheism. During the second hour, we'll be talking about limited theories of a limited God. And during the third hour, we'll be talking about the Christian view of God and man and the universe. Now, in the subdiscipline of metaphysics, such questions as what is real, is there matter, is there mind, what does matter mean, what does mind mean, what's the relationship between the two, if there are two things, is there a God, is there more God than one, is the universe created, or is the universe everlasting? That's the sort of question that is asked in the subdiscipline of metaphysics. And I want to begin by talking about atheism, which is a popular view of the 19th and 20th centuries. And if you would, turn with me in the Christian View of Men and Things to page 46. This is in the chapter on history, but Clark provides a long quotation from Bertrand Russell's Mysticism and Logic here. It sort of reads like the creed of an atheist. And I think we ought to take a close look at it, and I want to call your attention to it. Page 46, A Christian View of Men and Things. Notice what Russell writes, that man is the product of causes which had no prevision of the end they were achieving. That is, they had no purpose in mind, these causes. They were achieving a goal, but they had no vision of it, no intention, no conscious purpose. That man's origin, his growth, his hopes and fears, his loves and his beliefs, are but the outcome of accidental collocations of atoms. Accidental combinations or collections of atoms in motion in the universe. That's where man's growth, his origin, his hopes, his fears, his loves, and his beliefs result. It says that no fire, no heroism, no intensity of thought and feeling can preserve an individual life beyond the grave. There's no immortal soul. Once you're dead, you're dead. That all the labors of the ages, all the devotion, all the inspiration, all the noonday brightness of human genius are destined to extinction in the vast death of the solar system. The whole thing's going to wind down. It's going to become extinct. And the whole temple of man's achievement must inevitably be buried beneath the debris of a universe in ruins. All these things, Russell writes, if not quite beyond dispute, are yet so nearly certain that no philosophy which rejects them can hope to stand. Only within the scaffolding of these truths, only on the firm foundation of unyielding despair, can the soul's habitation henceforth be safely built. And these are truths, and you can only build on the firm foundation of despair. Brief and powerless is man's life. On him and all his race, the slow, sure doom falls pitiless and dark. Blind to good and evil, reckless of destruction, omnipotent matter rolls on its relentless way. For man, condemned today to lose his dearest, tomorrow himself to pass through the gate of darkness, it remains only to cherish, ere yet the blow falls, the lofty thoughts that ennoble his little day. Proudly defiant of the irresistible forces that tolerate for a moment his knowledge and his condemnation, to sustain alone, a weary but unyielding atlas, the world that his own ideals have fashioned despite the trampling march of unconscious power. This is the creed of an atheist. It's quite a realistic view of the implications of atheism. The universe is going to be in ruins. Everything we see is an accident. There's no purpose. There's no meaning. All of man's achievements are going to disappear in a conflagration at the end of the universe. Quite an eloquent statement of some of the implications of atheism. No purpose, no meaning. History, to quote Shakespeare, is sound and fury, signifying nothing. Man is meaningless. He's a detail in a vast universe. something that has been accidentally coughed up by a universe which is going to die eventually. There's no point to it at all. Now, this sort of view is not unique, of course, to the 19th and 20th centuries. The ancient atomists in Greece and Rome held something very similar to it. That is, the universe was composed of nothing but matter in motion. That's all there is matter in motion. There's no creator. There's no sovereign mind that has a purpose for the universe. Nothing of that sort. Well, what are some of the implications of this down through the ages? Well, man is minimized. The universe is big, and obviously it is big. Look through a telescope sometime. Go out in the country on a starry night and look up at the stars. If you can, look through a telescope at a nebula. Very impressive. It's very beautiful. And the universe is huge, and man is tiny. God is non-existent in this view. Through the Middle Ages, up until the time of Copernicus, it was commonly believed that the Earth was the center of the universe, the physical center of the universe. And then Copernicus came along, and he challenged that point of view. The results of that can perhaps be best seen in a quote from a famous German at the beginning of this century, Ernst Haeckel. And let me quote a couple of paragraphs from Haeckel. He was a very prominent popularizer of science, if nothing else, in Germany at the end of the 19th, beginning of the 20th century. He was one of the earliest converts to Darwinism in Germany, and laid much of the basis for the emergence of Nazism as well. This is what Haeckel wrote. He said, "The universe or the cosmos is eternal, infinite, and illimitable. Its substance with its two attributes, matter and energy, fills infinite space and is in eternal motion. This motion runs on through infinite time as an unbroken development, in the course of which countless organic forms gradually emerge. Our Mother Earth is a mere speck in the sunbeam, in the illimitable in the universe, and man himself is but a tiny grain of protoplasm in the perishable framework of organic nature." Then he continues, "Monistic cosmology proved that there is no personal God. Comparative and genetic psychology showed that there cannot be an immortal soul. Finally, the science of evolution made it clear that the same eternal iron laws that rule in the inorganic world are valid too in the organic and moral world. Man is a speck in the illimitable universe." This is one of the implications of this worldview, of this atheistic worldview. Well, I've already mentioned Darwin. Darwin, of course, published his Origin of Species in 1859, and followed that with subsequent works. His book was a bestseller immediately. The world was ready for it. And the book sold thousands of copies because this is what people wanted to hear. He provided, for the first time, what appeared to be a scientific basis for a belief in the evolution of species. But we're not interested in the biology so much as we are in the philosophical implications of what Darwin is doing. For example, if Darwin was correct, then man is not God's image. The account in the opening chapters of Genesis is simply wrong. Man is not distinct from the other animals, but he's simply the highest, in some sense, the highest animal, perhaps the most clever animal. Men are animals. That was one of the implications of Darwinism. Several people picked up on this whole train of thought in the 19th century. One of them was a German named Friedrich Nietzsche. and I'll read something from Nietzsche in a moment. he developed the idea of some of the philosophical implications of the theory of evolution. And he argued that man is a bridge between other animals and Superman. And he looked for the emergence of Superman. Now, this isn't the Superman of the comics or the movies. This is the next step in the evolution. There's no reason to think, of course, if you believe in evolution, that it has ended. Nothing at all. There's no reason to think that man is the goal of evolution. And Nietzsche saw that. He was brilliant. And he said, the next step I'm going to call Superman. It's a step beyond man. And he said, what we've got to do in the meantime is get rid of all these ideas that are interfering with the survival of the fittest. We have to get rid, especially of Christianity, with its slave morality, with the notion of kindness and generosity and respect for others, and service. We have to get rid of all that stuff. That's a slave morality. What we need is a morality that will enable the fittest to survive. The essential thing is the will to power. Not just survival, but the will to power. Life is a struggle for power. He even defines happiness at one point as the knowledge that one's power is growing. That's what happiness is. Logic is not the image of God. Of course, there is no God. One of Nietzsche's slogans was, God is dead. That's where the God is dead theologians of the 1960s got their inspiration. Now, if you go back and read the accounts of what was going on in the 1960s, you'll see this outburst of God is dead theology, inspired by Nietzsche's slogan. Consequently, logic is simply a tool of survival. It's not the image of God. There is no God. It's simply a tool of survival. Nietzsche says it doesn't matter to us whether something is right or wrong, true or false. The only thing that matters is, does it further my life? Does it enable me to survive? Does it enable me to succeed in the struggle for power? Right and wrong, true and false, are out the window. Now, Nietzsche wasn't the only one to see the implications of this worldview. Dostoevsky is credited with the saying, the Russian novelist is credited with the saying, if God is dead, everything is permitted. That is one of the implications. If God is dead, everything is permitted. Let me give you a quote from Nietzsche here. I think I can put my fingers on it rather quickly. This is Nietzsche's view of the universe. Shall I show the universe to you in my mirror? This universe is a monster of energy, without beginning or without end, a fixed and brazen quantity of energy. This, my world of eternal self-creation, of eternal self-destruction. This, my beyond good and evil, without aim, without purpose. Would you have a name for my world, a solution for all your riddles? Do you also want a light, you most concealed, strongest, and most undaunted men of the blackest midnight? This world is the will to power and nothing else. And even you yourselves are this will to power and nothing else. That's Nietzsche drawing out some of the implications of the atheism of the 19th century. Some of the implications of the notion of evolution. There was another fan of Darwin, very influential, Karl Marx, in the 19th century, also an atheist. He thought he had discovered the laws of social development, the development of societies, just as Darwin had discovered the laws of biological development, the development of species, of organisms. Marx, of course, as you well know, is co-author of the Communist Manifesto, wrote a number of other books, his most famous being Capital, Das Kapital, and was the inspiration for several totalitarian governments of the 20th century. Marx is easily one of the most influential philosophers in the history of philosophy. He died in, I believe it was 1883. Within 70 years of his death, the nations of Russia and all its satellites in Europe, China and its satellites, are under the sway of governments that identify themselves as Marxists. Not much of a time lag in Marx's case between the publication of his ideas and the emergence of totalitarian governments which controlled a quarter of the world's population. Extremely influential. He saw the key to understanding history in that he said history obeys laws, and those laws are economic laws. The laws of historical materialism, of dialectical materialism, the structure of production in a society determines the class structure of that society, and that class structure leads to class struggle, and the entire history of the human race is a history of class struggle, a class struggle which will continue until the final class, the last class, the proletariat, eliminates the bourgeoisie, the capitalists, and we usher in a classless society. He sees human society as violent. He advocated violence, violent revolution. Spent a lot of his money trying to foment a revolution in Europe. These economic factors determine everything. And his followers, as we mentioned, I believe it was last night, developed some sort of argument defending all sorts of immorality, from lying to murder to massacre, because those things would usher in the future. They were convinced that the future is on their side. It's interesting. One of the interesting things about Marxism or communism is that the true believers are so optimistic because they're so confident of their victory. The same thing goes for Islam. They succeeded in conquering North Africa and almost all of Europe because they were confident of their victory. People sometimes say that you have to believe in free will in order to stir people to action. Well, the most influential movements in history, Christianity, at least in the West, Christianity, Marxism, and Islam, none of them has believed in free will. They were confident of victory because they saw it assured, either by the economic forces of history, or by Allah, or by God, and consequently they acted. They said, victory is ours, it's time to act. And certainly the communists did that. Well, the irrationalists of the 19th century, the materialists, the atheists of the 19th century, had lots of 20th century disciples. Let me mention Sigmund Freud. Freud was actually a disciple of Nietzsche. What Darwin did in removing man from the position of being the image of God on earth, Freud did sort of for the individual. He removed logic completely. Reason or logic in the individual, according to Freud, is simply a faculty for rationalizing one's irrational impulses and desires. Man becomes the id rather than an image of the logos. The superego, he analyzes man into three parts, the id, the ego, and the superego. The superego are the rules of morality imposed by society. And the id is the basic nature of man. And the ego intervenes and arbitrates between the two. Logic is nothing but rationalization. It's not a way to truth. It's certainly not the image of God. Freud wrote books attacking Christianity. Finally, the last group of men I'll mention as being representatives of this worldview are the behaviorists. The behaviorists. These are the folks who say that, take it so far as this. Not only is there no God, there is no soul in the individual. The individual has no mind. These are the advocates of mindless men. The universe as a whole is without purpose. It's without God. It's without a creator. And men themselves, taken as individuals, have no minds. Let me read, if I could, from a couple of these men. Both of them Americans. This is almost entirely an American philosophy. And I'll begin with William James, very influential at the beginning of the 20th century. The psychologist William James. This is what he writes. He published an article in 1904 entitled, Does Consciousness Exist? In which he denied that it does. The stream of thinking, he said, consists chiefly of the stream of breathing. The Kantian or Cartesian, I think, is in reality, I breathe. Breath is, quote, the essence out of which philosophers have constructed the entity known to them as consciousness. That entity is fictitious. Thoughts in the concrete are made of the same stuff as things are, unquote. This is William James, one of the most respected and influential American philosophers at the beginning of the 20th century. Breath is the essence out of which philosophers have constructed the entity known to them as consciousness. That entity is fictitious. Another American philosopher, the gentleman who has heavily influenced, if not controlled, public education in the 20th century in America, John Dewey. These are some of the things that John Dewey wrote. Know where to begin here. He says, volition is a habit, and habits are adjustments of the environment, not merely to it. The mind is a complex of bodily habits. The mind is a complex of bodily habits. Habits formed in the exercise of biological aptitudes are the sole agents of observation, recollection, and judgment. I'm going to read that one again. Habits formed in the exercise of biological aptitudes are the sole agents, notice the word soul, of observation, recollection, and judgment. A mind which performs these operations is a myth. A mind which performs these operations, the operations of observation, recollection, and judgment, is a myth. Knowledge lives in the muscles, not in consciousness. Knowledge lives in the muscles, not in consciousness. You see how thoroughgoing the atheism is becoming. And not only has God disappeared, but mind has disappeared. There's no mind or soul, Dewey says. We are our bodies. Knowledge lives in the muscles, not in consciousness. Does anyone know what slogan in the field of education is attributed to Dewey? Learning by doing. Do you see why that slogan would be attributed to Dewey? Learning by doing? Because knowledge lives in the muscle, not in consciousness. There is no such thing as consciousness. He calls it a myth. So what you do is you train the muscles. You train them into certain habits. And it's not just, he would say, of course, it's not just the overt muscles, the movement of the arms or whatever. Thinking is actually the movement of muscles in your throat. It's inaudible speech. When you're thinking to yourself, you're speaking to yourself, no one else can hear it, and that thinking is those muscles in your throat moving. And that's a habit you have. You move those muscles, that's a habit. Consequently, American schools adopted this theory of learning by doing. They said it's wrong to expect the kid, the child, I shouldn't be so disrespectful, it's wrong to expect the child, since we have so many kids here, it's wrong to expect the child to memorize things. It's wrong to expect him to see how they fit together, to be able to understand them. It's certainly wrong to expect him to follow an argument. Now, what we need to do is we need to teach him by training his biological aptitudes. So what do? Well, we teach arithmetic, not by expecting a child to memorize the times table, not by expecting him to master long division. We teach arithmetic by having the child play store and make change. And then by counting out the coins and whatever, he can learn his arithmetic. That's how we do it. We learn by doing. Consequently, we are now blessed with a whole universe of school children who can't make change, let alone know the times table. So if you go into a fast food restaurant and look at the cash register, you'll see that it probably has pictures on the keys so that what the customer orders can be punched in by icon rather than by name or number, and the cash register will compute the total and the change due, and sometimes there's even a little chute down there where the change comes out. How do you teach drama when you learn by doing? Do you study the plays of Shakespeare? Well, perhaps. But if you want to do it Dewey's way, you write your own, you build the stage set, you learn by doing, and then you present it to the public. That's how you teach drama, in learning by doing. What you have as a substitute for the study of an excellent play by an excellent playwright is you have the students producing their own poor play, spending their time putting a set together, and then presenting it to their unfortunate parents. This is learning by doing. This is how you do it. And this has this idea that there is no such thing as a mind, there is no such thing as consciousness, that think what we call thinking is really biological aptitudes and the movement of muscles, is what has largely destroyed education in the U.S. In the 20th century. There are other factors as well. But Dewey, who was, by the way, an avid fan of Rousseau. If you read Dewey's works on education, he puts lots of quotes from Rousseau in because he agrees with Rousseau on the noble savage, as it were. Rousseau, of course, was very well. But this is about the end of the line for atheism. Now, you see some of the political and the moral consequences of this. If man is as Haeckel says, a piece of protoplasm, if man is a speck in the universe, then we should think nothing of eliminating men. Nothing. The communists, of course, didn't. The Nazis didn't. If this is what man is, then there's no good reason not to exercise your will to power, as Nietzsche suggested, and eliminate those who are not fit to survive. If God is dead, or God does not exist, the God of Scripture, then everything is permitted. What began as a denial of the existence of God ends as a denial of the existence of the image of God. Once you get rid of God, you cannot have an image of God. An image is simply a reflection of God. If God disappears, the image disappears too. So by eliminating God from this worldview, in this system of metaphysics, by eliminating God from the universe, they have opened the door to the elimination of men. Deicide, the murder of God, leads inexorably to homicide, the murder of men. There's no logical stopping point between the two. So by eliminating God, as the atheists do, they have paved the way for what we have seen in the 20th century, the emergence of atheistic states that have killed tens of millions of men. Now, are there any comments? We have a few minutes left. Any comments or questions? Yes, Frank. So far as we know, yes, I did say that. The 20th century is the bloodiest in history.
You were talking about 70 years after Marx died, all the things that went away.
Well, actually, it came into being before 70 years. If he died in 1883, I believe that's the correct year. Within 35 years, you have the Russian Revolution. And then in another 30 years, you have the Communist or the Chinese Revolution. It has disappeared in Europe, in the former Soviet Union and Central Europe. It hasn't disappeared in China or Cuba. The combined population of those countries is well over a billion people. But what is to be feared, of course, is that Marxism is simply one form of atheism. And unless the former Soviet Union is flooded with Christian missionaries and literature, there's no way that they will not revert to a totalitarianism. It's been touch and go for 10 years now there. Everything seems to hinge on Yeltsin's health, and his health isn't very good. His chief opponents are the communists. Everything has been touch and go there. There has been very little progress in the setting up the institutions of a free society, simply because these people do not have the theological background for it. That's right. And we're still living off the capital of past generations of Christians in this country.
We think in this country all you gotta do is have a democracy by letting everybody vote and solve all the problems.
Not quite.
It doesn't work that
way. No. Right. I've seen the latest figure on the gross national product of Russia, and it was appalling. It's half that of Mexico. And the latest figures on the gross national product of Russia is half of Mexico. Unless God converts millions in the former Soviet Union, unless it's flooded with Christian missionaries and Christian literature, the theological foundations that are necessary for a free society will continue to be not there, and the society will collapse back into some sort of totalitarianism. Yes, sir?
As one of our theories would do is telling Keller, Keller.
Well, I don't know if he ever discussed Helen Keller. That's a good question. I'd like to know what Helen Keller would do with Dewey. She might find a new use for her hands. There's a good example of a person who, you know, has virtually no sensory contact with the world. She's blind, she's deaf, mute, still has a sense of touch, but is extremely intelligent. She was an extremely intelligent person. Yes, sir. The brain is simply a physical or a biological organism. It fits in quite well with his theory. He'd say that thought probably is some motion in the brain. That's all it is. Any other questions or comments? Well, let's take a break and come back at, 7 o'clock?